Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Thursday, February 27th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And we have four bills to take up, and we're going to take the last one, which is our work session, first. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4038A. And Erin, could you please tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4038A requires owner of manufactured dwelling park to give written notice of owner's interest in selling the park prior to owner marketing park or considering park offers on park. Specifies a person's receiving notice and contents of the notice. Requires tenants to notify owner within 10 days of receiving notice of tenant's interest in competing for park purchase. Requires owner to disclose certain park-related financial information. Requires all parties to act in a commercially reasonable manner throughout the process. Specifies remedies available to tenants and owners should party fail to comply with measure. Excludes transfers due to death, gift, corporate, or partnership transfer, foreclosure, eminent domain, or transfer to charitable trust. Allows owner of park to file affidavit with county clerk in county in which park is located, certifying compliance with terms of measure. Allows absolute reliance on affidavit by party acquiring interest in park or title insurance company. Clarifies current statutes relating to marina and tenant associations. The A version of the measure takes effect 91st day after signing die. You have a -A8 amendment. It includes includes transfer or sale within an LLC as an exemption from process. Requires establishment and identification of single tenants committee if none already exist for the purpose of purchasing park and requesting financial information. It removes the emergency clause from the measure and act as effective January 1, 2015. You have no revenue and no fiscal impact on the A8 amendment.
Great. Thanks a lot, Erin. And I think we have two representatives to talk about this, Representative Nathanson and Wisnant. Would you like to come forward and kick it off? Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and honorable committee members. We'll try to be quick. Thank you for scheduling a work session on House Bill 4038A. Representative Nathanson and I co-chaired a work group in the interim to find a consensus bill to a 2013 session bill, which was opposed by the park owners. There's two groups of park owners. House Bill 4038 is a product of a lot of work by us and the stakeholders. With the committee deadlines of a short session, we passed House Bill 4038 out of the House with 60 yeses. One group of park owners still opposed the bill from the House and continued to work the bill in the Senate to reach agreement. All the stakeholders and legislators worked on amendments to present the bill you now have, the -8.
Yeah, A8, right.
And the park owners that were in opposition are now neutral on the bill. So I'd like to report to you that myself and Representative Nathanson believe this is a better bill than the 2013 bill and addresses the major concern of the park owners and the park tenants. Thus, we urge you yes vote on House Bill 4038 as amended in the Senate.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. I want to express appreciation to my colleague, Representative Wisnant. We had a lot of hours put into the work group meeting together and meeting with individual stakeholders. I feel very pleased with the outcome. Both sides gave a lot, and both sides are acknowledging that they had to give a lot. And both of us as legislators understand that. We realize it, acknowledge it. I want to stress that this is a real different approach than the bill that was heard in the 2013 session. Rather than looking at landlord-tenant law modifications, one of the objectives that we knew we had to reach with this work group was to reach something that was much simpler, not to try to address every single technical thing that may or may not ever happen, but something that was simpler and that complied with real-world standard commercial real estate sales. That's what was requested, and that's what we've done. It's simple. It's done in a very business-like standard approach, and that's why we think this one will work.
Great. Well, thank you both for your work on this and for bringing it to us. Are there any questions for the representatives?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't see any questions for you, Representative Nathanson. I know you're also here on another bill. Can you stay with us for a minute? I think we'll be able to knock this one out pretty quickly. Okay, thanks a lot. I think we have a panel of three people who need to come forward now and just give this their blessing. So if you could come forward, introduce yourselves, and please be very brief. I see one person. Do you have friends? I know you do, but are they here?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Want me to go first? I'll go first. And you can just nod your head or whatever, or disagree with me.
I can do that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Laningham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County in Eugene. I also want to thank Representative Nathanson and Wisnet for leading the interim work group that worked on and that produced this bill, and also Civil Help for helping me get here. I would note that in addition to what Representative Nathanson and Representative Wisnet said, this past weekend, Mr. Kosozan, on behalf of his client, suggested some amendments on Friday afternoon. I agreed, after consulting with the people working with me, I agreed to those amendments. Those amendments are the Dash 8, A8 amendments. They do three things. Your staff has described them, but in case you have questions, they remove the special effective date, so it's now has a regular effective date that will give the landlords more time to get ready for the impact of this new law. It adds an exemption. The current there, you should, I need to understand there already is current. I've talked to so many of you about this bill. I don't want to bore you, but there are already exemptions in the existing statute for this process, and those exemptions include things like partnerships. So transfer within a partnership is not required to go through this process. That exemption was written in 1989 before the use of common use of LLCs, so we're adding LLCs as one of the exemptions. It was one of the requests from Mr. Kosozan's client. It's a fair and reasonable request. If I had thought of it, we would have put it in there earlier, and it fits the sense of the current exemptions. And I should note that those two amendments were in the minority report that came out of the Senate General Government Committee 3-2. The third amendment has to do with a requirement that during the first 10-day period after the tenants get notice from the landlord of the landlord's interest in selling, the tenants have 10 days to do a couple of things. One is to indicate to the landlord in writing that they're interested in competing to purchase the park. The second is to form a tenant committee if there is not already one. Tenant committee doesn't have any particular legal meaning. Richard and I could be a committee if we were to get along. We could then indicate a representative, probably Richard, who would go to the landlord and say, I'm the person you deal with. And then after that, there's a 15-day period in which the tenants have to do other things. I believe that we have agreement on those amendments. We've worked hard to get them right. Chuck Carpenter was supposed to be part of this panel on behalf of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. He misunderstood the time. We believe that he's in his car frantically
driving. That's okay. We're going to be moving this bill very shortly, I think,
but
so we'll understand.
He's indicated to me that his board has supported this proposal from the get-go and is supportive still.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Richard Kosozan on behalf of the Oregon Park Owners Alliance. Mr. Van Laningham was correct on every statement with the exception of one, kind of the inference that we might not get along, and we get along all the time. The Park Owners Alliance provided some amendments to basically three people Friday afternoon, John Van Laningham, Sybil Hebb, and Mark Nelson, and those three should be thanked. I appreciate the time and effort they took over the weekend to work on the amendments and try to get to a point of agreement with all interested parties. We are neutral on the bill, but again, I'd like to state for the record I appreciate Representative Nathanson's work, Representative Wisnett's work, and the work of John and Mark Nelson and Sybil Hebb. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these good folks? Okay, it looks like you answered them all. Thanks again. And we are in a work session. Members, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash A8 amendments to House Bill 4038.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved the -AA amendments to House Bill 4038. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any objection to the amendment? Okay, amendment is adopted. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4038A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Vice Chair Farioli has moved House Bill 4038 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. And Senator Monis Anderson was the carrier of this bill originally and has volunteered to still see it through to completion, so we'll ask her to carry it again, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4038. And next, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4122. And Erin, would you please tell us about this one?
And Madam Chair, I will defer to my colleague to the right, Jen Nordland, who has worked on this bill throughout the process and throughout the ongoing efforts to get us here today.
Great. Okay, we'll take a moment. Oh, thank you. You're with us.
Yes.
Welcome to
Madam
Senate
Chair,
Rules.
Committee members. This measure requires that state contracting agencies and public corporations obtain quality management services from a qualified contractor on IT initiatives that are exceeding $5 million, or if the initiative meets three or more of the specified criteria. It requires QMS, that's a quality management services, it requires a contractor to provide a copy of the report to the state chief information officer, to the DAS director, and to any appropriate state agency board or commission. It requires the contracting agencies and the public corporations to consult with DAS and follow the DAS policies when determining the extent of the QMS or the preliminary quality assurance services that are going to be required for the IT initiative. It allows the state contracting agencies and the public corporations to procure preliminary QMS if their procurement meets standards described above, or if it's otherwise believed that the preliminary QMS will enable it to implement the IT initiative successfully. Requires the bidder and the proposers to submit an affidavit that attests that the bidder or the proposer has complied with state and local tax laws. The measure becomes operative July 1st, 2014, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has been issued. You also have before you the -12 amendment. A12. It modifies the definition for the Information Technology Initiative. It modifies the definition for QMS. The QMS will now also include a review of the contracting agency and the public corporation's performance, and it requires the QMS on the IT initiative exceeding $5 million or on any initiative that meets the criteria in the standards set up by DAS or the CIO. The A13 amendment requires a separate procurement on QMS if the IT initiative exceeds $1 million instead of $5 million. And there's no fiscal or revenue paperwork received on the A13. The A12 has a revenue impact, no revenue impact, and it has a fiscal statement issued.
Okay, thank you, Jan, for that explanation. And I think for people in the audience or who might be following this out in internet land, we just got this -13 amendment. Erin?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I received the -13 amendment just after noon. It was posted online about 12:15. So it does meet our one-hour requirement for being able to take action on it. We do not have a fiscal or revenue statement on the -13, though.
But we do on the
A12.
Okay.
Correct.
Great. And I know that Representative Nathanson is here on this bill, too, and I think also Representative Holvey. So the two of you would like to come forward. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For this record, I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. This bill is going to help ensure that information technology projects will be managed better in the future. It puts in place a process so that significant projects will have additional scrutiny, the oversight that they need to keep things from going south, or at least, if they are to make a mid-course correction to get it straightened out before too much time elapses. This bill addresses design and implementation of new IT projects. It was written so that it adds a layer of mandatory oversight that doesn't exist and applies to agencies with delegated authority to do their own purchasing. We're trying to make sure it covers more and that there's more scrutiny. Virtually every department of state government has IT projects. Looking at information available from November 2013, we know that the investment value of IT projects on the books, the ones that we can find, it's really hard to find them all in a reliable way, but at that time, November 2013, there was a total value of nearly $560 million over 17 different projects, ranging from about $2 million for the planning phase of ODOT's DMV, driver license issuance replacement program, to about $230 million for the state radio project that's providing communications for law enforcement, transportation, and others throughout the entire state. It looks like seven projects are between $1 and $5 million, and 10 projects are over $5 million. There are several distinct elements to this proposal. First, define when a project must have a separate third-party quality assurance, or QA, who it applies to, and what they need to do. Second, we want to make sure to get copies of the QA report to people in key positions so that someone else will be reading it, not just a project manager who might say thanks and put it in a drawer. And third, we want to keep tax evaders from securing projects for these projects. The way the bill is written, including the Dash A-12 amendment, which I do recommend, this bill will not slow down or add cost to routine business. It will exclude run-of-the-mill information technology work, but it will get at the larger projects. If they're over $5 million, they're automatically included under these rules, under this statute. Or if a project meets at least three of several criteria, then it also falls under this statute. Those criteria include if it's over $1 million, if it's mission critical, for example, state police dispatch and records is mission critical, or applications for licenses and permits to keep the state's business and commerce moving along every day, or a new system for child welfare reporting. Those are examples of mission critical. Another criteria is if it's designed, managed, or used by multiple agencies. For example, the business registry, which is used by the Secretary of State, Departments of Revenue, Employment, and Consumer and Business Services, and the private sector. Or another criteria is if it will take more than a year to develop. The bill also gives rulemaking authority to DAS, the Attorney General, and to contracting agencies to implement with additional detail or clarifications that are necessary. The Dash A-12 amendment continues with further clarifications to ensure that the understanding is that we are doing quality assurance on a project, not just an individual contract, but the entire project. The point is, the program needs to be implemented. It needs to work from start to finish. We want to make sure that what is delivered are preliminary as well as final reports, not just a final report after there have been amendments and adjustments. We want to make sure that all the key people get even the preliminary reports so they can understand what might not be going so well that they need to do something about. It clarifies who gets the reports. There's a list of that. It makes sure that everyone understands that the current exemptions in other parts of our statutes for Secretary of State and State Treasurer apply to this as well. So that's in there. There are also, it's written so that it's technically correct, so that this contracting law statute is in sync with other parts of our statutes, for example, IT, information technology statutes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8. So I think Representative Nathanson has given you a very good introduction of what this bill is attempting to do, and I'd just like to add a few points to that and perhaps a clarification as well. As we see IT, you know, becoming more and more of a piece of, you know, conducting our business at the state, I think this bill is a very much needed step in the direction of having some sort of oversight and really quality assurance that the project's going to work and we're going to get our value out of that investment. As we know in today's world, everybody is being subject to, or is subject to being hacked. I don't know that there's any foolproof way to prevent that, but we want to make sure our systems are as good as we can get. So the a couple pieces that I did want to flag, you know, as Representative Nathanson was walking through the criteria of the $5 million, and I just heard about the $1 million suggestion in the -A13, and we did talk about that quite extensively. I believe right now one of DAS's policies on agencies that they have authority over is at $1 million to consider quality assurance contracts. But as this bill basically ropes in other state agencies that aren't underneath DAS's authority, including public corporations, we didn't want to expand further and lock in that $1 million for everyone at this point. And one of the things that the A12 amendment does do as far as the criteria besides the $5 million consideration is its criteria or standards, instead of looking at, you know, all the different specifications of the $1 million criteria that you see in the A.N. Gross bill, it takes some of those criteria out and leaves it up to the criteria or standards that the state chief information officer or the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services specifies by rule or policy. So that does give DAS the authority to continue to require quality assurance contracts on some agencies at the $1 million level, which they currently do, but also allows them to, you know, look at each individual, you know, project or initiative to make sure that as Representative Nathanson was suggesting, whether it's mission critical, whether it really needs to be implemented on that $1 million project. So I do recommend the A12 because of that reason. It provides a little bit of flexibility as we go forward, as we see the Chief Information Officer office and the position starting to play out and really get established. We're trying to grow with that office as well with this piece of legislation. I've been working with the governor's office and trying to make sure that this bill is aimed at the future with the planning that we're looking at for the Chief Information Officer and his responsibilities, which I think there's another bill in Ways and Means that is dealing with some of those issues. So I do recommend the A12 version of this bill. We've been working, like I said, very closely with the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Governor's Office to make sure that this is something we can implement now. Great step forward. I think that this is a much better criteria and requirement, and provides us a little bit more accountability for our government projects right now going forward. I think the conversation's going to continue, fairly certain it will continue, around quality assurance contracts in the world of information technology. And just to reiterate something that Representative Nathan said, that it really is important to think of this in terms of not just the procurements, but also the agency resources and all the investments that we're making into these IT projects. And those are technically called information technology initiatives, because we can't really use the word projects in the public contracting code in this frame. So I thank you very much for your time. Happy to try to answer any questions you have.
Okay.
Okay, thank you both for your work on this and for bringing it to us. And members, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives, thank you for the work on this bill. Senator Johnson has asked me to raise a couple of questions, if I can put them to you. And she had gotten a email from a constituent of hers who is a senior executive with a large software company, and he has stated here that he is very supportive of the intent of the bill, but he raised some questions which I think fall more into semantic, but I'm just going to raise them with you and then I'll let you guys address them. He says that the language in the bill on quality assurance implies to the testing phase of software development. And he said the problem with that is that often problems that arise in the software development, the problems often arise in the software development. He says catching problems during testing is long after the horse has left the barn. And he thinks you need to make sure that it covers the full life cycle. And his two comments were the bill should ensure that the scope of the role of the independent assurance contractor covers the full life cycle of software development projects from requirements gathering through deployment, testing, and release, and he was concerned that the independent contractor should have the authority to make changes to correct the project. Reaction.
I don't know if you had a chance to see these questions ahead of time.
Well, not really. I think my reaction up front is that the quality assurance contract could very well include all of those pieces that you're talking about. And I think many of the vendors that do quality assurance contract, at least the information that we've received on the House side also, spoke that many of these quality assurance contractors are there at the ground floor just in writing the specs of this and also providing that oversight of the project just as an engineer does in a construction project all the way through the entire project and then is able to, you know, issue reports along the way. And so I think that though the quality assurance contractor may not specifically have the authority by himself to make these changes, I think that would be up to the contracting agency to listen to that contractor and take that recommendation and make those changes along the way. So I don't think that I don't really see that issue as being a problem in this particular legislation. And I know that the governor's office is also in the room and may be able to speak to how that works. But my understanding is these quality assurance contractors do generally follow these projects all the way through.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Nathanson.
If I might, I'd like to add on to what Representative Holvey said. Department of Administrative Services has published administrative rules on what quality assurance means and what a QA contract should cover. In other words, what the QA person should be looking for. It's really quite comprehensive. And I'd like to quote from that, just a piece of it. It actually goes on for several pages, but I think the relevant part is what caught my eye. Already. The purpose of the contractor's work is to assure that appropriate levels of quality management activities are performed throughout the project lifecycle. These quality management activities must be sufficient to assure that the project satisfies the needs for which it was undertaken and that project risks are well understood and appropriately mitigated or managed. Quality standards shall refer to both project process and product quality standards. Process quality standards shall cover organizational influences, management support, decision drivers, project management, schedule, resourcing, experience, and others. Product quality standards shall cover product content, design, development, deployment, environment, technology, security, maintainability, and others. So I think this is an example of where the statute has a certain amount of words in it to get us pointed in the right direction. DAS already has administrative rules on the books that describe a very comprehensive array of attributes of what these services should include.
Did you have another?
Okay.
Senator Farrioli, did you have a question?
I have a slew of questions, Madam Chair. Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank the author of the Dash A12s, and I believe that may be Representative Holvey. But I'm not sure because nobody claims this amendment. So
I think these witnesses are here in support of this amendment and have worked on it.
Yeah, but I wanted to commend the author of A12 because it does solve a number of the problems that were inherent in the bill.
I appreciate that, but I can't take sole credit for authoring. It was actually a collaborative effort with Representative Nathanson, myself, committee administrators, staff, and getting feedback from DAS and the governor's office. So it was a collaborative effort. This bill did come through the House committee that I chair, and so I've been involved in it all along the way, and Representative Nathanson as well. You know, she's sort of the, I'll call her the guru from Ways and Means in some of these areas for the House side.
Madam Chair, follow-up. I don't know that this is aimed specifically at any particular IT project, but would you care to characterize our past performance with IT projects that this is aimed at addressing?
Well, I think we've had a lot of problems with a lot of IT projects, as I think you'll find that a lot of other people have too. Target, Bank of America, I can go on and on and on, but we've had problems with OWIN, with Cover Oregon, with, a lot of our IT projects. And I think that, information technology is just exploding, and it's very difficult to stay on top of what, you rely on the experts in these fields and the companies that supply this sort of service. And at some point, if I had to do it, I'd be putting my faith in the experts to deliver what I hope to get. But we're just trying to make sure that we, the best we can, have some accountability for this. I don't know if I answered your question, Senator.
Madam Chair, I think that was admirable. And if I could continue.
Another question?
Yes. Sort of to follow up on Senator Byers' issue, the oversight, from your testimony, I conclude the oversight's focused on more than just the development phase, but we'll really follow the project all the way through to completion. Is it your impression that this project could deliver a final product, that meets all of the testing requirements through the development phase and everything we asked for? There was responsiveness from the contractor, and we delivered it on time, under budget, et cetera, and it still doesn't do what we thought it needed to do. I mean, in other words, it doesn't work. I guess what I'm asking you for is it your intent to engineer a program that will prevent failures on delivery? And does this bill do that?
I guess our intent would be to come close to achieving that. I don't think there is a perfect. I don't think there is a 100% assurance that something won't fail. I know lots of people that work for major corporations who struggle with this same issue. But I think this bill takes us several steps closer to helping ensure we have fewer failures and of less magnitude.
Madam Chair, I agree. I think that's clearly the intention here. And I hope it does get us closer. Do you think this might have, Madam Chair, changed the quality of the conversations we were having throughout the Cover Oregon development if we have this bill in place?
I would say yes.
And I would concur, primarily because there will be more eyes on the program. It won't be limited. We've included not only this, the director of DAS, Department of Administrative Services, the chief information officer, the director of the agency. If there is a governing board, the governing board will get a copy of the report.
And I might add that the report is coming from the quality assurance contractor, not from the agency. So they're going to get a direct copy of what the contractor and the vendor is saying.
Madam Chair, if I could continue the, I think one of our, well, there's a whole bunch of issues that I think this bill addresses, particularly A12. One is not always knowing the right question to ask. Another is getting a different a piece of information from the agency director versus the contractor, and legislators are then, you know, listening to maybe the same question answered, but different characterizations that are hard to reconcile. We have learned recently that it's possible to place witnesses under oath for their testimony. Do you think that would add a dimension in any sense to getting, you know, at least a coordinated piece of information from all the witnesses?
I haven't contemplated that, actually.
I wanted to just clarify, are you asking about placing all witnesses at legislative hearings under oath? Or?
Well, Madam Chairman, I think when you've got a contractor in front of you who's got a multi-million-dollar contract at stake, or an agency head whose professional reputation depends on being on time, under budget, and delivering as promised, there's a tremendous pressure on those people to put the best face and best foot and best story forward. And we currently do not ask for those pieces of testimony to be added to the record under oath. And I think that might change the quality of the conversation. But, Madam Chair, I'll withdraw that question. I've got just two more I'd like to ask. You mentioned the A13 amendment. That amendment is something that I've brought to the committee because I wonder if it's possible for a project to be broken into components that add up to $4,999,098 and break that into three different parts and have a multi-million dollar project that, if aggregated, would clearly be over $4.9 or $5 million, but in fact they're finessed by the contractor or the agency head who doesn't want to bother with this pesky oversight stuff from the legislature. Is there anything in this bill that prevents the disaggregation of projects that would essentially be subject to the bill if they were aggregated?
Madam Chair and Senator Farioli, this is something that we asked about early on and got clarification on because we, too, anticipated that would be a way to get out from under oversight. There is already a statute in place that prohibits agencies from artificially separating projects into pieces, and that in conjunction with this bill, because this bill now with the A12 addresses the entire project. Because another thing that I had anticipated is an agency to not hit the $1 million mark, for example, might decide to contract with a vendor for around $800,000 worth of resources and then ask for authorization for some limited duration FTE to add to the agency and add a couple $100,000 worth of agency resources to do some other parts of the programming work. So I've had several discussions like this with the Legislative Council and with DAS to make sure that the way the statutes are written and the way this bill is written, we're talking about an entire project, and it doesn't matter if you separated it into pieces. It's the value of the and the other criteria of the project, not just a one number of one single contract.
Madam Chair, that I find to be reassuring. So it's your opinion that disaggregation would be a violation of Oregon revised statutes?
Madam Chair, yes, I think that is prohibited.
Okay. And Madam Chair, who is the organization group or are there individuals in the legislature that would get an unexpurgated, unredacted, unvarnished, unpolished report on the project? How does the truth and nothing but the truth get to the legislators that have the responsibility for oversight?
I'll take a stab at that one. That was another issue we really tussled with, quite frankly, was the information that would come back to the legislature and how that comes back and whether or not we should be named in the bill. We came to the conclusion that, these functions are really executive branch functions, and for the legislature specifically to be named to receive these reports would imply that we had some authority to change or stop or require a different contract, which I think is a little bit over our authority. So the answer to that is that since the CIO, the director of DAS, the contracting agency, all have, you know, copies of the report from the contractor, and it's a public record. And during our budgeting process is when we ask for that accountability. Currently, under through LFO, essentially, the Legislative Fiscal Office would ask if they were looking at an individual project. I believe they would ask for this information. They would ask to see ask for that copy. And it's my understanding that agencies don't usually deny giving those sorts of documents over to Legislative Fiscal Office because their budget's on the line. So really, we only have the authority to really look at this when we're in session and going over the budget. For us to imply that we could get a copy of this report in the interim and actually change the course of the project, I think would give people a false sense that the legislature actually has that power. And it kind of puts us on the hook for something that we don't really have the power or authority to do. So we're going to have to rely on our budgetary cycle to review these, and I don't suspect that we'll have any problem getting our hands on the unredacted copies of those contracts, I hope.
Madam Chair, thank you. Implicit in that response that agencies don't usually fail to comply indicates that they might sometimes fail to comply. I guess that's the strongest argument I can make for putting agency heads under oath and saying, is this all the information you have on the topic? And if not, please provide that for the committee.
Well, let me clarify what I said, Senator, Madam Chair, if I might. I'm not aware of any agency that's refused to hand over documents to Legislative Fiscal Office. Somebody else may be able to answer that question, so I don't know if that's a problem or not.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I'd like to make one short addition. I, too, believe that if the legislature were named as getting regular reports, if we were listed in the list of recipients, the same as the CIO and the board of directors of a governing board and so forth, I believe that there's a chance that that could give an agency a false sense of security in thinking that they're off the hook for a while, because even though the report had gone to other places, it's the legislature who really cared. If, let's say, at the end of the first 90 days of a project, something wasn't starting to look right, but the legislature didn't happen to be in session, I don't want an agency to think they're off the hook for another 6 months. If the report comes in at 90 days and it's going south on that day number 91, someone ought to be doing something about it and bringing people in saying, what are you going to do to fix this? So I just want to indicate my agreement with Representative Holvey's response, and I wouldn't want agencies to think they can be off the hook until we happen to be in the building again.
Madam Chairman, I just love the term going south. I agree with it. I'm not going to ask these two fine representatives if they've ever been lied to in this process, in this building. They know the answer to that question. I know the answer if it was asked to me. But I will tell you that I think there are places where folks will look back at the record and knew that Cover Oregon was going south and either put a good face on it or didn't point it out to the people that had legislative oversight for responsibilities, and it went all the way south. And I think this bill is a great step in the right direction. I intend to support the -812s on the bill. I'm going to move the -13s with no hope that anybody will pay attention to the fact that I expect there to be disaggregation as a routine practice, even though I agree with Representative Nathanson that it's against ORS, probably unethical at minimum. And, Madam Chair, I think we should be willing to put agency heads and contractors under oath when we ask them, are you on time? Is the project going to deliver a project as promised? And when they tell us something that's not clearly supported by the facts, that should indicate future action, budgetary and otherwise, for legislators. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Senator Farioli. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you both being here and the work you've done in this.
Then let's do it.
Just two questions. Why do we not apply this to the Secretary of State and the Treasurer? I recognize they're independently elected constitutional officers, but you know, why wouldn't we assume the same kind of scrutiny that we're going to put every other agency under for those two very important functions of state government?
Madam Chair, at this time, because it's a short session, and we recognize you can't change the world all in a 2 or 3 week period, we think it's the most straightforward and the most prudent thing to do is to make this bill match what's in practice in the contracting statutes and in other places. Those two offices, Secretary of State and State Treasurer, are already exempt, and we're just trying to keep this parallel with what has been the custom.
Additional?
Yeah.
Oh, did you want to respond to?
I think that's a great question, Senator Starr. And as Representative Nathanson said, this is a short session, and you know, I was going to make a comment when Senator Farioli finished, is that this is an evolving issue, and we can intend, I think both Representative Nathanson and myself, intend to keep working on this issue to see where it goes next. And as with a new director or at the CIO office, you know, getting his feet on the ground and, you know, trying to work with the governor's office to, you know, see if there's more we can do. I'm sure there is. And so we'll keep working on this. We just wanted to get the groundwork laid right now as fast as we could so that we can start working on it and making it a better program. As far as the other agencies that are involved, it does get sort of difficult sometimes because, as you know, in procurements, there are many agencies, including this body, the legislature, that are exempt from the public contracting code in the procurement world. And so it's a little bit more complicated to start rewriting statutes to around these QA contracts to include everybody that's already exempt under the public contracting code as well. So we're taking steps. This is incremental.
Thank you. I appreciate the responses. And my other question really was along the lines of Senator Farioli's as it relates to the legislative involvement in this process. I would suggest that it would be wholly and absolutely appropriate for the legislative fiscal officer, for instance, to be added to this list. It's not, you know, it's not the Senate president, it's not the speaker, but it is really the person to whom we entrust with helping us make sure that that each dollar that we appropriate as the legislature, and that's our job, and we do have a serious and real responsibility of oversight. You know, I don't see a problem adding the legislative fiscal officer to the list of individuals that would be getting these reports. And if there was a state agency director that somehow thought that, oh, just because the LFO officer was getting these reports, they didn't have to do anything until the legislature came back, I would suggest that agency director is undeserving of the position that person was holding. So I find that argument really is not to hold water. Our responsibility as legislators really is an oversight function. We are here to on behalf of the constituents that we all represent, to ensure that the laws that we help to pass and the budgets that we pass, the direction that we help to set the state on is where the state is going, and us having that oversight, I think, is important. I'm going to support this. I'd hope that we contemplate, think about, and if we come back to this, that we would add the legislative fiscal officer as a list of folks that would get these reports. Perhaps in the rulemaking process, that could be done as well.
Okay, thank you, Senator Starr. I don't see any more questions for you, so thank you again for all the work that has gone into this and for your testimony today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and we don't have anybody else signed up to testify, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4122 and open a work session on House Bill 4122. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -A12 amendment to House Bill 4122A.
Thank you. Vice Chair Farioli moves to adopt the -A12 amendment to House Bill 4122A. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Okay. Amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I'm also going to move the -A13 amendments to House Bill 4122A.
Okay, Senator Farioli has moved the dash A13 amendments, and of course we don't have all the paperwork on those, but I will certainly entertain your motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there discussion? Did you want to speak on your motion?
Madam Chair, just briefly, I think the move from a million to 5 million just invites a disaggregation, and I believe that there's no real good reason to make the change. This is a process of iteration. There's a lot of changes in this bill. I think the Dash A12 amendments improves every one of the processes, but I believe if we don't keep the existing limit, we're going to see disaggregation. It's going to come back in a form that will be embarrassing to the legislature. So I would suggest that we leave that piece of the law alone, because if we change it, it'll be an open invitation for people to game the system, and we will see people gaming the system.
Okay, further discussion on the amendment. Okay, Shelley, could you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer.
No.
Senator Burdick.
No.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli.
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum.
No, and the motion fails. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4122A as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Vice Chair Farioli has moved House Bill 4122A as amended by the Dash A12 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, is there objection? Okay, motion carries. And
I dare you, Madam Chair.
No, I don't want to live. I don't want to live that dangerously. We still have a few days left. So let's see, Senator Beyer. I know that you deal with contracting issues in your committee frequently. Would you be willing to carry this?
I would be happy to.
Okay, we'll have Senator Beyer carry this on the floor, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4122. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4155. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4155 authorizes Public Employees Retirement System Board to establish procedures for recovering administrative costs from participating public employers for providing to these employers information or services needed to report in compliance with generally accepted accounting principles. There is an emergency clause on the measure. There is no revenue impact. A fiscal statement was issued on the measure. It does come to you from your House floor with 57 aye votes and 3 members were excused that day.
Okay, thanks to Erin. And we have 2 people signed up to testify, and they're Paul Cleary and Gary Blackmore. Did you both want to come forward?
Okay.
Good afternoon. Thanks for waiting so patiently.
Thank you. No problem. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cleary, the Executive Director of PERS. The Governmental Accounting Standards Board, which sets uniform standards for financial reporting for state and local governments in the United States, has created several new standards for public employers to report pension-related information. This bill basically would allow us to expend funds to provide the information that our employers need to comply with those standards. Really, it's an administrative efficiency and cost-effectiveness measure. We think that doing this work at the system level, where in essence we already bake the loaf, will be the most efficient way to do it. Then we can just slice it up and give it to our give that information to our individual employers. I know you've received a lot of testimony from a number of employers. I think a pretty good sample of the 900 employers that participate in our system in support of this bill, and we think it's a good bill and ought to pass. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Blackmer, Director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. I had very brief testimony. This is important for accounting standards and for ensuring public scrutiny of the liabilities that governments incur, and that providing an audited statement on their financial statements is critical to the 900 organizations that are PERS employers, including the state of Oregon itself. And a clean financial statement is important for getting federal grant funds as well as borrowing money and getting good credit ratings. And so if we were not able to provide this kind of information to those jurisdictions, there would be an opinion that had question marks on it that would raise issues with New York credit rating industry and other people in Washington, D.C. So I do urge you to pass it.
Thank you both for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Thanks again. And we do not have anybody else signed up to testify on this bill. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4155, open a work session on House Bill 4155. We don't have any amendments, right?
No,
and this is ready to move.
Just need to pass that amendment.
Senator Farrioli?
Madam Chair, move the House Bill 4155 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farrioli has moved House Bill 4155 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. And do we have a volunteer to carry this one on the floor? Senator Starr? Okay, great. Sure. Senator Starr will carry it.
Really, really hard ones.
could be a rival for an important but not necessarily exciting.
The most boring bill of the legislative session.
I don't know. That seems to be a contest we have running on the Senate floor.
I certainly won't be as entertaining as a carry. This is the last most boring bill of the session.
Okay, thanks, Senator Starr. I'll close the work session on House Bill 4155.
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Farrell.
Can we refer to it as the grand bargain for PERS?
Oh, my God.
Use it for every bill that rule puts out, perhaps we could kill that phrase.
Maybe we could have a naming contest as a benefit for the food drive. Okay. So we've got one bill left, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4156A. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4156 authorizes Department of Human Services to appear as party in juvenile court proceeding without appearance of Attorney General in any hearing held after hearing is required by ORS 419B sub 305, and in any proceeding where a district attorney appears on behalf of state and positions of DHS are not in conflict. The provisions of this measure do sunset on June 30th, 2015. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We did receive an amendment this morning, the -A3 amendment, which specifies type of information that may be presented during proceeding by DHS, clarifies that DHS may appear without Attorney General when parties are not in conflict. We do not have paperwork on the A3 amendment. You do have a hand-engrossed version of the measure with the A3 amendment available to you on OLIS.
Okay, thanks, Erin. And we do have three people signed up to testify. And so I'll call Lois Day first, and then Jessica Adamson and Joanne Sethi. I guess you can all three come forward because we have three chairs. Good afternoon. Thanks for waiting so patiently, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human Services. House Bill 4156A, I'm here to testify in support of this bill. This is a time-limited statutory fix to allow legislators and stakeholders in the juvenile dependency process time for a full conversation about the issue of department representation. ORS 9.320 requires that state agencies appear by attorney in all cases unless specifically provided otherwise by law. That's what we're seeking with this bill. Historically, the Chapter 9 statute has not been enforced in juvenile dependency proceedings. DHS appears frequently without our counsel present in a number of hearings, but we engage representation by the Department of Justice when needed. Recently, some judges have begun enforcing ORS 9.320, requiring the department to appear through counsel at every hearing. Currently, the department is not budgeted at a level that supports attorney representation at every hearing, nor is the Department of Justice staffed at a level that would make that possible. As the bill was originally entered, there was some conversation with stakeholders about some unintended consequences, which is what the amendments have addressed. Again, the bill would provide an exception to ORS 9.320 that maintains the process in juvenile dependency proceedings as they function today. It's time limited, allowing time for a full consideration of the issues and implementation of a sustainable resolution. That said, I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 4156A, and we are opposed to the Dash 3 amendment, believing that would carry the very fiscal that we're attempting to avoid. And I can answer any questions that the committee
has. Great. Did you have a question, Senator Biden?
Reading the Dash 3s, it looks like it does what you said. Could you explain why you're opposed to it?
What we understand is that given the way the Dash 3 is written, introduction of evidence, testimony, that the judges interpret that as being almost every hearing in the dependency process, and so they would require us to have that counsel with us for that. As I understand it, judges take the court reports, which the statutes in 419B require the department to provide to the court, and they enter them into evidence. The department doesn't offer them as evidence, but they enter them into evidence. And so the interpretation of that would be that with that Dash 3 would be that we would need counsel with us at those proceedings.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And why don't we complete the panel, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of Youth Rights and Justice. We, since 1975, have represented over 50,000 families, parents, and children in juvenile dependency cases in Oregon, and are appreciative of the opportunity to have been a part of working on this bill in the House. We had concerns about the base bill and worked very closely with DHS and other stakeholders to address those concerns in the House, and we supported the base bill, House Bill 4156A, as it came to you today. We still support that bill. We, like DHS, are opposed to the Dash 3 amendment. We believe, as stated by Ms. Day, that this amendment would, in fact, undo the intent of this bill and result in, from our perspective, the concern is it would result in a lot of delay. And in these cases, that's not ideal for families. It's not ideal for the kids involved. And we would oppose the Dash 3 amendment. But it supports the underlying bill and urge you to pass it along today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Joanne Stalky here. From
you might need to move the mic a little bit toward you, but not too close. You only need one.
Joanne Stalky from the Department of Justice. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division and the attorney in charge of all of the DOJ lawyers that handle the child advocacy work statewide. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm here to report that the Attorney General is neutral but concerned as to the bill that you have before you as the Dash A engrossed. In an attempt to remedy some of those concerns, the Dash 3s were written up kind of hastily and circulated and proposed, and we understand that there are stakeholders against the Dash 3 amendments, but wanted a chance to kind of describe the purpose behind those amendments for the benefit of the committee. As the Attorney General understands it, the goal of this legislation that DHS has proposed is to preserve the status quo around legal representation of DHS in juvenile dependency proceedings. I'm offering this testimony in my role at DOJ, but also as an experienced practitioner. I've practiced in about 17 counties statewide and can attest to the fact that the juvenile dependency process is not consistent from county to county, and judges are not consistent in how hearings are handled from county to county. The Attorney General wanted to preserve the status quo, but while avoiding a fiscal crisis for the state and precluding an emergency around uncertainty and potential delay in permanency for children and families in Oregon, the Dash 2's amendments were quite broad and open to interpretation, and the Dash 3 amendments attempted to narrow that broad language and address the vagueness issue. The Attorney General, as a former judicial officer both for the trial and appellate level, believed that the Dash 2 amendments, that removed the word uncontested prior to hearing, left the language to read that DHS could appear without the Attorney General at any hearing. The dash threes were meant to narrow the types of hearings at which the at which DHS could appear without legal counsel.
And Ms. Sethi, just to clarify, the dash twos that you referred to are the A. Engrost bill, correct?
I'm sorry, the A. Engrost bill, correct.
Right.
The Attorney General wants a bill that is lawful, consistent with current practice, time limited, and also allows the state to thoughtfully consider options prior to the next legislative session about increasing legal representation of DHS. Currently, as many of you know, DHS is often the only unrepresented party in the courtroom, which has led to some concerning results. Whatever form this bill takes will require tracking, and DOJ is committed to track the results of this bill. And I'm available to answer any questions. Oh, and one more thing, I'm sorry, is that the Dash 3 amendments were intended, at least in theory, to clarify and more clearly restrict what is the unauthorized practice of law, which was also a concern for the Attorney General.
Okay, I think Senator Beyer has a question.
I do have. It sounds like there's general agreement that over the next year or so, I guess going into the next session, that you collectively want to work on this problem and refine the process, recognizing that judges differ between counties. And unfortunately, apparently, the historic practice has been challenged by a couple of judges recently. If I'm reading the A3s correct, what you have here is that may appear, but it doesn't preclude DOJ from determining that it wants to appear in any case. It just authorizes the department to, I guess it takes the cloud away from a local judge saying, yep, law says you got to have a DOJ attorney with you, which probably, you know, given the nature of the juvenile process, which is supposed to be relatively informal, doesn't make a lot of sense in most cases. So I'm not sure I see a need for the A3.
If I may respond, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think the preface language, which talks about subject to or notwithstanding the provisions of 9.320, which says a state agency cannot appear without counsel at any court hearing. So notwithstanding that, this would be the specifically otherwise provided by law piece, but subject to the unauthorized practice of law. Right now it reads that DHS may appear without the Attorney General at any hearing. So it's unclear and I think would lead to different levels of interpretation about when an attorney would be required and when not. The attempt with the dash threes was to narrow it down to clearly, as much as possible in these kinds of cases, identify when a hearing would be contested and would require an attorney to represent the agency's interests, which would encourage all parties in juvenile cases to be a little more thoughtful prior to the hearings to identify issues, if whether witnesses would be called and whether exhibits would be offered.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Farrioli, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I do have a question for Ms. Southey, and I'm going to try to phrase my question in a way that builds on knowledge that I have and does not ask her to pass on the relative fitness of judges in this area of the law. I've had judges tell me from rural communities they're very uncomfortable in cases where DHS issues, particularly pertaining to custody, are litigated without having someone not directly connected with DHS but perhaps representing them in the room with the level of expertise to advise the court in the answer to questions that it may have. And in absence of that person, it's unlikely that there'll be somebody in that room representing the parents or grandparents or children that would be able to answer the question about DHS procedures and laws with that level of expertise, certainly not the DHS personnel who are not attorneys. So, Madam Chair, I've been told by judges, current members of the bench, that their level of comfort in those proceedings is vastly improved by the presence of a DOJ attorney. So if this is moving forward without the dash three seems to leave that in question. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I would still enjoy a conversation.
Okay, so I don't know.
Madam Chairman, we don't need to have our conversation during
the
our hearing.
Great. Yep. Okay, great. So I take that as more of a comment than a question.
It is a comment.
Ah, okay. Any other questions? Yes,
Madam Chairman, I assume we don't have a fiscal on this, on the dash three yet.
No, we don't. And we're not planning to move this bill today because we do need to meet again. So.
Well, we do need to meet again and discuss this. I think I would like to have every single person have a lawyer at every single proceeding. But that would be so expensive, so I'm going to be very interested. I know that the intent of the A and Gross bill is to maintain the status quo, and I think the worry about the dash three is it might include too many proceedings, more proceedings than we can accommodate from a fiscal standpoint. So I'll be anxious to see the fiscal impact statement on the dash three.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Just a clarification for me. My understanding is in these proceedings, what usually have lining up there is you have the local district attorney representing the state. You have an assigned attorney representing the child or children. You may have a CASA, depending on what the local judge does. In fact, you may have on the parents, you may have an attorney representing one or both of the parents. So it's not like we're not without a whole lot of attorneys there, and it's not like the state is not represented.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, if I could respond to that. It's true that pre-jurisdictionally the petitions are carried forward most frequently by the local district attorney on behalf of the state. The district attorney at no time represents the department. Post-jurisdictionally, most district attorneys step out of the case, and at that point DHS is present as a party, as are the parents, perhaps a CASA, and the child. With this bill, we're not saying we do not want representation in court, and we use the Department of Justice now for representation in many hearings. Whenever we believe or we're informed it will be contested, we seek the services of the Department of Justice. This really is to hold things steady until we can come up with a resolution that is sustainable and affordable.
What's your billing rate?
I believe it's, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe it's $154 an hour. And I may be a little off because I know it was changed recently.
So, and I did have one more question for you. I think we will need to bring this back. But so in this dash 3, which I know you said was pretty hastily drafted, but on line 6 and 7 saying that DHS can appear without a lawyer at any hearing that does not require the presentation of legal argument, evidence, or testimony of witnesses, what would those hearings be? I mean, are there a lot of hearings that don't have legal argument, evidence, or any testimony?
Madam Chair, I think the attempt was to there's many hearings in juvenile court proceedings, as you probably are aware of, heard.
How
and
do it?
While there may be something at issue generally in the fact that parties have different positions, there may be a hearing that's a status hearing or a kind of check-in, follow-up hearing that would not necessarily require an in-depth legal argument or a presentation of evidence, which was a way to summarize what the practice of law would be to avoid and make it more clear for judges and other parties to recognize when a hearing would perhaps be contested, when there would be evidence presented to advocate for a position. So with those guidelines, there may be hearings that fall outside of that, but it's a status hearing. It's a check-in prior to a trial or prior to another review hearing where the court is required to make findings, but there may not be evidence submitted or witnesses called. And again, it was an attempt, I believe, to narrow the language from the A and Gross, which just said DHS can appear without counsel at any hearing, period.
And I mean, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but it just seems like if a judge is going to hold a hearing, they have to be considering something. I mean, that language sounds like there, it's hard for me to envision, but I don't obviously have your expertise, whether that's a universe that really is very many hearings.
And again, Madam Chair, I think this would be to preserve the status quo, which is what's currently happening. There is the question, of course, this raises about what is the unauthorized practice of law, and if these things are being done, would that be considered the unauthorized practice of law? And there's still a risk, the Attorney General believes, under the A. Engrossed, that certain judges will interpret the language that's written here to require an attorney at every hearing.
Okay, well, obviously there's more work to do on this, and we are not at signing day yet, so there's still time. Okay, so I think that's everybody we had signed up to testify. Is there anybody here who needs to testify on this bill today? I don't see anyone. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4156. And members, we are on 1 hour notice, as I keep reminding myself. So stay tuned. And with nothing further to come before us today, we're adjourned.